This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This week, a report from State Attorney General Brad Schimmel revealed that he's recommending contempt proceedings for a prosecutor and eight other officials over the leak of John Doe investigation documents. He's not, though, seeking criminal charges. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He is based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday to look back at the week's biggest news. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thank you.
All right, so this is a complicated story. There was the whole John Doe probe. There was a leak to the Guardian newspaper and then an investigation into that leak. What was your biggest takeaway looking at the report from the Attorney General this week?
Well, there are a number of pieces of news here and things that had not previously been reported, so there are a lot of them. I agree with you. Really, the headline is that there were no charges here. It was certainly possible to imagine that the Attorney General would have wanted to charge the leaker in this case. The reason that there were no charges, according to the report, is that the way that the evidence in this case was handled meant that there were multiple people who were in a position to have been able to leak these documents. And so that is where a lot of the strong language came from, that was a mishandling of these documents. But it's also why we didn't see charges.
Right. And I think the Attorney General's office was clear. They think something illegal did happen, something chargeable did happen. But as you were saying, Rob, it's hard to say who did this thing.
Right. I mean, the documents were sealed. It was presumably an illegal act to share them with a journalist. People leak things all the time, and it is a they have their own motivations, and there might be good to the public to know some information that gets leaked from various documents. It's also the case that there were people who were under gag orders in this same investigation whose homes had been raided by investigators, who were also legally forbidden from speaking about it, who shared with the Wall Street Journal and others who were sympathetic to them to sort of plead their case. But yeah, I mean, sharing those documents, those documents were legally not supposed to be released to the public.
And another thing that people are pointing out here, this goes back to the John Doe 2 probe, accusations, concerns that Governor Walker's campaign had coordinated with outside groups. This was ultimately stopped by the Wisconsin Supreme Court back in, I think, 2015. But what people are saying is released here is the Government Accountability Board, which existed at the time, which did this investigation, vacuumed up a lot of information, had a lot of information in its servers and files, some of it personal information, and they didn't do a great job, people are saying, of protecting that information from being released.
I mean, it seems, yeah, I would say that the record on what happened to those existing documents would support that view. Now, yeah, this is, in fact, one of the big pieces of news out of this report is that there was a previously unknown third John Doe investigation into a bunch of Republican officials who were apparently coordinating campaign activities with the Wisconsin Club for Growth, this right-wing group. And at the time, before the Supreme Court weighed in, Wisconsin's campaign laws forbidden that sort of campaign coordination. A lot of those rules are no longer in effect, but that was one of the things that was being investigated that we had not known, and that, yes, led to a bunch of personal emails and other sort of non-material emails being collected by the investigators. This is like this is a big part of the Republicans' case that against the John Doe system, and the reason why the rules around it were changed is that this is the sort of investigation that kind of can continue to grow. If you're a Republican, you're convinced that this was a sort of a partisan tool all from the start, and prosecutors were just going to keep investigating until they found something that they could use for a partisan end. And I don't know whether it's true or not, but you can hear as soon as I say it that it's the exact same complaints that Democrats had about special prosecutors investigating President Bill Clinton in the 1990s, or that Republicans have against Robert Mueller Mueller's investigation into President Donald Trump today.
We'll be watching the fallout of that story. I want to start to pick up another thread here. Here in Wisconsin, we're watching federal efforts at a tax overhaul. There's an analysis out of the how the U.S. Senate's tax bill would affect us here in Wisconsin. What are some of the takeaways there, Rob?
Sure. Well, I mean, the tax bill isn't law yet. It's going to go to a conference committee, and so who knows what will happen. But here we are with an analysis of this Senate bill. And the bill has this odd structure that is a way of getting around deficit rules, and that is that it has a bunch of corporate tax cuts that are permanent, but it makes individual tax cuts temporary. And so you see in this analysis, if passed, a family in Wisconsin making about $70,000 per year or less would get an average tax cut of $440. But then those tax cuts all expire. And so by 2025, those same households would end up with a tax hike, an increase of an average of $190.
So that's all subject to change. We'll pick that up with Rob Mentzer from the USA Today Network Wisconsin in just a few. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What were your reactions to this release of information about the John Doe investigation documents? Should there have been criminal charges? Should there be contempt charges? Coming up, we're going to talk about the growing pool of Democratic candidates for governor in 2018. Who are you supporting right now? What do you think of this huge field of candidates? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at the biggest Wisconsin news from the past week. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the race for governor in Wisconsin, the leak in the John Doe probe. The documents came out this week. Call 800-642-1234. Going to go right to a caller. Nate is on the line in Milwaukee. Hey, Nate.
Hi, thank you for having me. My take on this when I first heard about it is that Republicans are trying to distract from that the governor's campaign had basically broken standing election laws during the time of the election that they were investigating. And to distract from that, they're trying to come down on the investigators and ignore that not only did he break the standing law at the time, but the Attorney General and conservative members of the state Supreme Court tried to help cover it up by basically smashing the law that he had been caught breaking. And Scott Walker himself was actually fond of election laws relating to finances and stuff like that. If you check the Koch call where he was called by a prankster pretending to be David Koch, and he admitted to trying to look for ways to catch state Democrats in.
Nate, I want to jump in. You got a lot there, and I want to bring Rob in on this now. And that's the counter argument, Rob, to what we're hearing this week from Republicans on this investigation, the report out this week, that they say, hey, the governor, or it looked like, they say, the governor's campaign and these outside groups were colluding, which was retroactively declared not illegal.
Yeah, I mean, they were coordinating. Like, that was definitely happening. So, the Republican case here is that the Wisconsin's laws on campaign finances were too overly broad, so much so as to be unconstitutional, and that especially in the post Citizens United era, they were not consistent with free speech rights as campaign finance law has evolved. Now, you know, sometimes courts find that the Supreme Court has the legal right to make that determination. But like, yeah, I mean, there's a political angle here, and it's certainly the caller is not wrong to point out that it was the court's conservative majority who made this finding that so happened to be very beneficial to the state's conservative governor.
Nate, thanks for the call. Rick from Wausau now brings us into the governor's race. Rick, hi.
Hello there. I wanted to comment on especially the Democratic race for governor. It's my personal belief that whoever wins that race will be the next governor. But I also think that it's time for ordinary citizens to become elected officials. I think what we heard back in 2016, whether you voted for Trump or against Hillary or vice versa, is that we're tired of having these polished politicians almost being drafted to be groomed to run government and answer to corporate donors.
I got your point, Rick, and we're close to out of time. And, Rob, there's a growing field now. Kelda Helen Royce, a former legislator, one of now a dozen officially declared Democratic candidates. And if the Democrats are anointing someone so far, they haven't done it yet, right?
Yeah, I mean, no, Rick makes an interesting point, and the real contrast here is to 2014 when the Democratic challenger to Governor Walker was Mary Burke, who there really was not another serious Democratic challenger for the nomination. There was a primary, but the other candidate was a former state legislator who ended up getting less than 16% of the vote or something like that. And that really was a case where Burke was the sort of chosen by the party regulars, and you know, that was, she had a tough campaign. It was a tough year to run against Walker, but it didn't succeed at any rate. And so I think that could be part of what is going on here, besides just this sort of activist energy being on the Democratic side right now, is that the party is going to let these dozen candidates sort of slug it out, and there can be a benefit to parties to having a contested primary. Wisconsin's primary is late; it's in August, and so that probably makes some political types a little nervous. But yeah, I mean, sometimes these debates can end up energizing people and getting people excited.
We'll leave it there for now. Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Metzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday to look back at the week's biggest Wisconsin news. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On Monday, President Trump announced he's reducing the size of two national monuments in Utah, Bears Ears National Monument and Grand Staircase Escalante. This is the largest rollback of federal land protection in the nation's history. Here's President Trump in the Utah State Capitol making that announcement.
People think that the natural resources of Utah should be controlled by a small handful of very distant bureaucrats located in Washington. And guess what? They're wrong.
John Ruppel is an associate professor of law and a fellow at the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah. He's also a plaintiff in one of the legal challenges against the president's proclamation as part of his role on the board of directors of the Friends of Cedar Mesa. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
So on a practical level, when national monument protections are taken off of, say, an acre of land, it becomes just a different category of federal land. What changes for that acre?
The protections or the management requirements associated with that land revert back to those that were in place prior to the designation of the monument. Most significantly, when lands are set aside as a national monument, the president withdraws those lands from availability from disposal under federal land laws and from availability for leasing for oil and gas development or for availability for future mining claims. Now, existing claims are protected, but future ones are no longer allowed. So when the president cut 85% from Bears Ears, those lands that are excised from the monument are now potentially available for oil and gas development. That's the most significant change, but there are also a number of other changes to day-to-day management. It could also potentially affect funding for monument operations as well.
And there'd been a fairly recent expansion of Bears Ears under President Obama that I think it's fair to say, controversial. There were people who liked it in Utah. There were people who didn't. I mean, did President Obama go too far in expanding Bears Ears?
Well, Rob, you're correct in that the monument was set aside less than a year ago. President Obama set it aside on December 28th, so it's been around for less than a year. Did he go too far? You know, that's a matter of opinion. But I think it's important to understand how the monument came about. There's been talk of protecting lands in southeastern Utah going back to at least the 1930s. Within the last, I'm going to guess, about 7 years ago, the tribes that claim southeastern Utah as kind of their home, they came together and started developing a proposal to protect those lands. They tried to work with Utah's congressional delegation to move that proposal forward, but that was ineffective. And essentially, they drew about a 1.9 million acre boundary based on interviews with tribal elders and cultural leaders and their understanding of the way that landscape was used. That proposal went to President Obama. President Obama then made a decision that based on other competing values, energy development, uranium development, other resources, he was going to trim that area back to about 1.3 million when he designated the monument. So what he set aside was actually quite a bit smaller than what the first inhabitants of that region and the proponents of that monument were pushing forward.
Can you talk about what is in the land that had this monument protection and would have that withdrawn by President Trump? What kind of features, what kind of significant sites are there?
Well, this is an incredibly rich cultural landscape. Native American use of this region goes back over 13,000 years, and the Congressionally Chartered National Trust for Historic Preservation described the area in its comments on the protection by saying that perhaps nowhere in the United States are so many well-preserved cultural resources found within such a striking and relatively undeveloped natural landscape. So it's really a remarkable place in terms of the archaeology, the cultural values, and the nature that is there.
And now, as we mentioned, you're on the board of directors of the Friends of Cedar Mesa, which is filing suit against President Trump. A lot of groups, Native groups, some businesses, environmental groups are filing suit. What are the grounds for the lawsuits trying to stop President Trump cutting back on the size of these monuments?
There are a number of arguments that are being made, but at the center, I think the most important argument to understand has to do with the president's authority to do this. Now, the president cannot act without a clear base of authority, and that can come from either of two places. It can come from the U.S. Constitution, or it can come from a statute that was passed by Congress. If we look at the Constitution, it provides to Congress, and to Congress exclusively, the power over public lands. So the president doesn't have any inherent authority there. Congress did delegate the power to create national monuments when they passed the Antiquities Act of 1906, 111 years ago. But the Antiquities Act doesn't discuss the power's ability to reduce national monuments. And earlier this year, 121 law professors from around the country sent a letter to the administration saying that we don't believe that the president has the authority to eliminate lands within a national monument. Now, the counterargument to that is that presidents have indeed reduced monuments in the past. Congress hasn't objected to that, and that lack of objection, at least in the minds of some, creates an understanding that that power exists in the president. But the problem with that argument is, first of all, it's been over 54 years since the president last reduced a national monument. Those prior reductions have never involved the kind of scope and drastic reductions we saw earlier this week, and they've never been done for these kind of naked political reasons. Besides that, Congress in 1976 passed comprehensive public land legislation, reining in the president's implied power over public lands and exerting its own power. So we think there's a very, very strong legal argument here that the president went too far in really cutting to the heart of both Bears Ears and the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument.
We're talking to John Ruppel, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Utah, looking at President Trump's announcement that he would reduce the size of national monuments in Utah, including Bears Ears. There are legal challenges in the works. John is part of a group that is doing one of those challenges himself. John, one of the fundamental arguments here in Utah and a lot of other southwestern and western states is that the federal government owns a lot of land and in some cases has heavy protections over it, especially in cases of national parks and national monuments, and that ultimately is a damper on the economies of those states. Is that a valid argument?
Well, I think part of that is correct. If you look at a state like Utah, it's correct to say that about two-thirds of the land within the state is federally owned, so that we're talking about lands here that belong to all Americans and lands to which I think all Americans have a legitimate claim to those interests that are contained in them. As far as the economic impact, Monuments can have a very positive impact on the local economy. If we look at Utah again, we have five national parks. Four of those, Arches, Bryce Canyon, Capitol Reef, and Zion, all started out as national monuments before Congress said these places are really special and need to be elevated in terms of their protection. Now, if we go back to 2014, the most recent year I have data for, we look at those four parks and we see together that they generated over about 6.7 million visitor days. That generated about $500 million in visitor spending and created about 7,500 jobs. So that's a really positive impact. If we look closer to the Grand Staircase, if we look at the two counties that surround that, we see that personal income, per capita income, employment, and population have all increased since that monument was set aside. So it's difficult to make this argument, or at least substantiate it factually, that monuments are somehow devastating local economies.
Now, we're talking to you from Wisconsin. We have public land here, but not to the extent that you would in a state like Utah. You're on one side of this argument, but is this something that you see as bitterly dividing people in your state?
You know, when we talk about public lands, particularly in a state like Utah, again, we have about two-thirds of our land is federally managed. That requires federal land managers to balance a lot of competing interests, everything from oil and gas development, mining, off-road vehicle use, hunting, to wilderness preservation and archaeological protection. And that balance is very difficult. Well, all of us agree that the federal government has to strike a balance. It's very difficult finding a balance that is agreed upon by all. And I think that's really the heart of this debate. There are some folks that feel, one, that balance wasn't struck in the way that they wanted, and I think there's some other folks out there that would argue that they didn't have enough of a voice in some of those decisions. That, again, doesn't really hold up when we look at the process that was used to generate the monument, but that's another story.
Is this a problem that Congress could make a difference in, maybe by updating or revising the Antiquities Act?
Well, Congress has plenary power over public lands. They have the ability to come in tomorrow, pass legislation that ratifies both Bears Ears and the Grand Staircase, as proclaimed by Presidents Obama and Clinton, and set make those boundaries permanent. They also have the ability to do away with those monuments entirely or adjust the boundaries. If they do that, or if they propose that kind of legislation, then we have an opportunity as a public to engage through the democratic process and discuss the pros and cons of that. So that's one possibility. They could also, Congress, when I say them, I mean Congress, could step in and amend the Antiquities Act to change the process by which future national monuments are set aside. And frankly, those are big-scale policy decisions that probably need to occur in the halls of Congress, where we can have that democratic process, where people can weigh in more broadly rather than have it done through presidential fiat under what are at best kind of questionable legal authority.
And in practice, this is going to end up in the courts. Do you have any sense of a timeline for when this is going to start actually becoming a court case?
I can only speculate. As you mentioned, I'm on the board of directors for Friends of Cedar Mesa. We are a plaintiff. We are being represented by outside counsel. We've been generously represented by Hogan Lovells. And, you know, I'm not the attorney of record on this, so I can't speculate about what that process would be going forward. I think it's going to be a long and complicated battle, particularly if we start looking beyond a single monument like Bears Ears and we start looking at multiple monuments. And as your listeners are probably aware, Secretary Zinke has recommended reductions to a number of monuments above and beyond what we saw earlier this week with Bears Ears and the Grand Staircase.
John, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob. Have a great weekend.
That's John Ruppel, Associate Professor of Law and a fellow at the Wallace Stegner Center for Land Resources and the Environment at the University of Utah. He's also a part of a group that's a plaintiff in the case against President Trump's decision to shrink two national monuments.